Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Before we begin this morning's case, I want to assure you that today's arguments are in fact being heard by Judge Posner as well as Judge Hamilton and myself. Unfortunately, at the last minute, Judge Posner is not able to be here, but he is going to listen to the tapes of the oral arguments and will participate fully in the decision of these cases. So we will proceed as follows, and we are ready for the first case, Rupert against Alliant Energy Cash.
Good morning. I had originally requested 4 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to change that to 3 in light of the fact that they reduced the time of the oral argument.
The lights will tell you when your rebuttal time starts.
Thank you very much. May it please the court, my name is Amy Benson. I represent the defendant appellant Alliant Energy Cash Balance Pension Plan. This case calls upon this court to once again decide whether a cash balance pension plan violates ERISA. Fortunately, the issues before the court have been previously defined, and it is largely a matter of application here. The plan raised 6 issues in its brief. I plan to discuss 3 of them here: the interest crediting rate issue, the statute of limitations, and the application of a pre-retirement mortality discount. On the interest crediting issue, the question is whether the amended plan's methodology for calculating future interest credits that adopts an up to 5-year average violates ERISA, and did the district court err when it applied a damages remedy fashioned under the original plan to the amended plan.
But, you know, there's some slippery concepts here. You guys are very careful to call it an up to 5-year rolling average, for one thing, which means that in some years it's 1, and in some years it's 2, and it finally gets up to 5 by the time you get to 2002. So it's not really a true 5-year rolling average to begin with. Secondly, in the Thompson case, actually that isn't what gets used ultimately, so it's not really very good authority for you. And thirdly, the district court seems very clearly to me to have ruled that the revised plan did violate ERISA.
Sure. Let me address those issues. The up to 5-year average is an acceptable methodology.
Well, I'm not sure. It depends on the language of the plan. Doesn't it depend entirely on what the plan promises people?
This plan promised people an up to 5-year average. The reason why the up to 5-year average was chosen was because the plan only began in 1999.
No, the plan is amended in 2011, and one of the questions is whether this amendment, which is retroactive to the beginning of the plan, is something that's acceptable under ERISA when it freezes people into this 5-year rolling average without allowing them to time the moment that they ask for a distribution. Most of these people, by definition, aren't even working for the company anymore. They don't have to take the distribution in 2000 or 2002 or any other time.
So there's an issue of the up to 5-year rolling average, and then there's the issue as to whether it is unfair because it precluded them from timing their distribution.
But the thing is, there's some amount that they have in their plan as of 2011 when it's amended. And what you're doing is you're manipulating that amount. The district court finds, she says, in an order dated July 2, 2012, I granted plaintiff's motion for summary judgment that Alliant violated ERISA when it used a 5-year rolling average to calculate future interest credits. That sounds like a merits ruling to me. I have no idea how else to read that.
The district court actually amended her judgment. The amended judgment that was filed on September 5th or 6th does not state that she found that the up to 5-year average interest methodology violates ERISA. What it states is that there was an underpayment of lump sum benefits.
That's the same thing. I mean, she doesn't really have to reiterate everything she said over the many years of this litigation every time, does she? That's the law of the case, as she says.
If the district court's decision was determined under the original plan, which did not adopt this methodology, and then she simply applied that as law of the case.
But that's not what she says she did. She says the 5-year rolling average is inconsistent with this court's previous order. She says there's a violation of ERISA when it used a 5-year rolling average. There was no 5-year rolling average in the original plan, so how could that be a statement about the original plan?
What she says there is that, as she stated in previous orders, she found that the up to 5-year average violated ERISA. If you go back and look at the previous orders, I think she refers to the July summary judgment order of 2012. In that order, she said, I've decided this issue before. If you go back and look when she decided the issue, she decided the issue before the plan was amended, and she simply decided that she was going to apply her 8.2% remedy determination. And let me address that, why that matters. This court in Thompson said it's up to the district court, once there's a violation, to determine a damages remedy. However, the Thompson court also noted that a way around this would be for the plan to procure an amendment to correct the violation.
And we understand that, but the problem is with this amendment. It's not, could there be an amendment? The problem is this amendment, she says. That's what we're reviewing.
We are also asking this court to rule that even if she did make that ruling, that it violated ERISA, for this court to overturn that decision. The up to 5-year average methodology was accepted by this court in Berger.
Right. The problem, though, seems to be the retroactive nature of this amendment.
I
wish I had could fill in my NCAA brackets this week, and picking a methodology for with retroactive effect for people who took their lump sum payments years before doesn't seem to me to be a very reliable way of correcting the problem the district court found.
Well, once it was encoded into the plan, then presumably there would have been some retroactive form of the amendment. ERISA does not preclude retroactive amendments, and the plaintiffs do not argue that ERISA precludes retroactive amendments here. So first of all, they don't dispute that. Let's address the issue of the fairness question. The plaintiffs were precluded from electing to receive their lump sum distribution at a time when the interest rates were the highest.
And, you know, the plan itself, the thing that's wild to me about this is, in general, for ERISA plans, forget about the facts of this case, a longer period of time, 10 years, 15 years, is going to be a smoother projection of where investments are going to go. The stock market bounces up and down over short-term periods of time, and this looks very much like the plan said, aha, the market was in an historic low during 3 years during the dot-com bust, so let's stick people with that, even though you wouldn't like it if it happened to be the boom years that led up to that. It's a very short-sighted strategy, and one I think that, as I've been saying, since people didn't have to take their distribution at any time, there's a problem with this retroactivity.
Again, ERISA does not preclude retroactive amendments.
But it does preclude depriving people of vested benefits.
This was not a vested benefit. The judgment that was entered here was not a vested benefit or an accrued benefit.
The judgment may not have been, but the as applied to the rights that were exercised to lump sum payments, surely those were vested benefits.
The lump sum payment was a vested benefit.
So the district court found that the vested benefit had not been fully paid, right?
The district court found that the up to 5-year average was not there.
No, I think what Judge Hamilton said is right. The district court found the payment wasn't enough, that more had vested by the time people took their payments.
The district court did not find, there is no finding, nor do plaintiffs suggest that there is any finding, that the application of the five-year methodology...
You're not answering the question.
You are asking whether this is an anti-cutback issue, and the answer is no, it has never been raised. Plaintiffs do not challenge the retroactive amendment of this plan, and the district court never made that finding.
But the plaintiffs are saying, we got X dollars when we took our lump sum, and it should have been greater than X, because there should have been an interest accrual that is greater. So the district court holds a bench trial, properly taking an ex-ante approach. What would they have really written into the plan if it wasn't this whipsaw kind of plan? And comes up after listening to lots of expert testimony with this 8.2, which would have yielded, you would agree, won't you, a bigger lump sum distribution.
I would agree to that.
That's good. That at least gets us on the same factual page.
Could I ask you about the statute of limitations issue? If we agree with you on the statute of limitations in part, in essence, if we were to apply Thompson so that the statute is 6 years running from the time of a lump sum payment, what is left of Class A and what is left of Class B?
If you apply Thompson so that it is the determination that the cause of action accrued upon the payment of the lump sum benefit,
right. Then
anyone who received their lump sum after, I believe it's August 17th, 2002, would have a timely claim.
I understand that. I'm asking, how many people are we talking about? Are there members of Class A who received their payment after that date?
Yes.
And are there members of Class B who received their payment after that date?
Yes.
Okay.
The payments were made between 1999 and 2006 when the law was changed.
Okay. One of the questions that I had for both you and plaintiff's counsel has to do with this notion that the 2011 amendment somehow mooted plaintiff's earlier claims. The parties and the district court seem to have agreed about that. I frankly don't understand that. It seems to me that at best what you've got in 2011 is, from plaintiff's and the district court's perspective, a partial and inadequate remedy for the claims that were being asserted earlier, but no new injury.
I agree with that. What the defendants had argued was that the earlier claims were moot because they had received all the relief that they could obtain,
your theory being that the amendment trumps everything.
Correct, that the amendment adopted an interest rate methodology that did not violate ERISA. The district court determined that there was an additional claim to be made, but nevertheless determined that the case was moot. I don't believe that it impacts the issues before this court either way.
Let me ask one thing about this that's relevant to the statute of limitations. As I understand it, for these participants, they ask for a lump sum payment, as is their right. They get the payment. Do they have any further relationship with the plan from that date on, other than as opposing parties in the lawsuit?
No.
Okay, there's no continuing
obligation. They have left the plan, yeah. If mm-hmm. that's your question.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Let me go back to the violation issue. The Berger Court looked at two potential methodologies for calculating future interest credits. One was use the year of distribution. In other words, if you elect to receive your lump sum distribution in a year where the plan is paying a 4% interest crediting rate, that's the rate that's going to be applied to calculate future interest rates. The alternative was use the year of distribution and some years prior to that. The Berger Court held that both methodologies were compliant with ERISA in that they were unbiased and fair estimates of future interest credits.
But doesn't it depend on the details of the plan? I mean, the Burger Court has a plan in front of it, but the general rule is that you need to create a fair estimate of the future credits that somebody would receive under the plan we're talking about, the actuarial equivalent. And so I'm concerned at the generality of your reading of Berger.
Well, it's not only Berger. Berger was dealing with a different interest rate methodology.
Isn't that important?
No, because the issue is the actuarial equivalence and whether it is a fair and unbiased estimate. And we have.
Aren't we doing clear error review on the district court's finding that the 8.2% was a clear, you know, a valid estimate?
Well, no, you're doing de novo review on whether the up to 5-year methodology violates ERISA.
Well, but she finds that the best actuarial equivalent is the 8.2 after finding facts. Now, you surely don't think she could have done this without hearing testimony. This was a fact finding on her part.
Correct. But Berger holds that there is no one actuarial equivalence. There is no one required methodology. And that is why it looked at two different methodologies and said that either would be a fair and unbiased estimate under ERISA on the theory that they are unbiased.
How can it be unbiased when it's being done retroactively?
Berger was done retroactively. Thompson, the court stated that it could perceive no problem with this.
But that's not what the district court did on remand. You're talking about the footnote in Thompson, aren't you, which is just sort of a dicta aside.
Well, the important issue that Thompson raises is the difference between determining whether there is a violation and determining damages. The issue before this court is, under the amended plan, was there a violation of ERISA?
Well, it sounds to me like what you're saying is you get to calculate how much damages you owe, right? Because this is, I know it's a cash balance plan, but it is a defined benefit plan. And to the extent it's overfunded or underfunded, the employer winds up being responsible for the difference, right? Or gets the benefit of the difference.
Correct.
Right? And so after the district judge finds a violation, these people were paid inadequately under their vested rights. You're saying you guys get to go back, you know what the interest rates were, what the earnings were, and you get to propose a new method that will cut back on the remedies available to these people. And I don't see why you couldn't 5 years from now say, oh, by the way, we're going to do a retroactive cutback again. We're going to do another retroactive amendment and change the way we calculated these things.
Well, Thompson recognized that the plan sponsors could amend a plan to correct a violation. That's good public policy. That's what happened here. The plan was amended after the receipt of the IRS determination letter that the plan had been seeking for a long time.
The letter which says we're only talking about taxes, not anything else.
That's correct, but it required a methodology in order to have tax qualified status.
Sure, but that's for tax purposes. You have tax accounting and regular accounting. I mean, I think you...
Well, I think that even in the Pension Protection Act, it has codified the 5-year average. This is an average that's
planned. That's sort of far afield from this case. You're not qualified under that.
The issue.
I will remind you in your rebuttal time. You're free to stop if you would prefer.
Yes, and I would like to just make one statement that the issue is whether it's an actuarial equivalence, and this has been accepted by Congress in codifying the Pension Protection Act. It's codified into Treasury regulations, and it's twice been accepted by this court.
Before,
thank you.
Ma'am, before you sit down, one of the big issues you've raised is this pre-retirement mortality, the death discount. Okay. I'd just like to ask you a couple of questions about that. First, is it correct that the surviving spouse for an employee who, when an employee dies before age 65, has the option of leaving the account with the plan so that the surviving spouse would gain the benefit of future interest credits?
The surviving spouse can choose between a single life annuity or a lump sum distribution. The surviving spouse, once the participant dies, if they don't elect the lump sum distribution, is going to start receiving their single life annuity.
Immediately?
Yes. Okay. The plan provides for in the month following the death.
Okay. And then, as I understand it, under ERISA, I think it's section 1055 in the code, ordinarily a pension plan requires some kind of pre-retirement survivor annuity, but that can be avoided if you have this lump sum payment in full. Is that right?
Not necessarily. The spouse has to consent to the lump sum payment if it's above a certain level.
Okay.
And the lump sum payment that's required by ERISA, this joint survivor, qualified joint survivor annuity, is calculated with the application of a pre-retirement mortality discount.
Okay, that's as clear as mud to me at this point.
My time is up, but it's set forth in our brief, the discussion of the qualified joint survivor annuity. That is a required annuity. That's the required annuity that ERISA mandates. The spouse can, under certain circumstances, elect under the ERISA statutes to receive that annuity as a lump sum payment. The ERISA statute 1055 says in calculating that you can apply mortality factors.
Okay. You're asking us to either limit or overrule Berger on this issue.
Absolutely not. Limit, yes.
Okay. If I understand your position correctly, if death before age 65 were to reduce benefits payable to the spouse by as little as a dollar, then you would be distinguishing Berger and saying it's not benefits paid in full? And that's enough to distinguish
Berger? That's not quite our position. What our position is that the spouse here has no entitlement to future interest credit.
I wish you would answer the question the way Judge Hamilton put it, because I had the same question.
It's the limiting case.
You think it's more than a dollar here, but your principle seems to be if it's anything less, then it's not inside the Berger rule.
If it would reduce it by a dollar, then yes, the application and the pre-retirement mortality discount could reduce it by a dollar, but it's not going to go below that point.
That seems to be a shift from your opening brief to your reply brief. I was not at all clear whether you were looking at this in an all or nothing basis or in a marginal basis or anything else. Your position has not been clear. Anyway, thank you, and I would like you to add 5 minutes to Mr. Gottesdiener's argument, and we'll let you have your 3 minutes of rebuttal. No, it's okay. I think that more or less balances things out.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could, to stay on the pre-retirement mortality issue just for a moment, counsel did not accurately answer the court's question about the terms of the plan. If the court refers to our brief, page 42, note 16, 5.1 of the plan absolutely, literally allows the spouse to defer and obtain all the future interest credits. It's as plain as day. The defense is not accurately telling the court what happened below, telling the court what the terms of the plan are. On the pre-retirement mortality discount, the court has put its finger exactly on the shift and the illogical position that they're taking. If there's a forfeiture of $1, you forfeit everything entirely. The death benefit here if anything, is better than the death benefit in Berger, the difference is imperceptible. With respect
on the death discount issue, quantitatively, how big an effect are we talking about here?
The benefit itself, if the discount is applied, could be as much as 10% to 15%.
The discount in the lump sum.
Yes.
Okay.
But as the court's suggesting, that what they're saying is that mathematically that there is a chance that there would be a chance that there would be no payment payable, which is clearly not the case. If you have somebody who has a $10,000 account balance and the value of future interest credits were $1,000, they would like to treat that $10,000 as the spouse receiving zero. Their argument is, well, if some of the future interest credits are forfeited of $1,000, then they get, you know, then it's treated as zero. And that just doesn't make any sense.
But maybe you can use a... So suppose somebody's leaves the plan and they die at the age of 55, and the full the time would be 65. So the plan is saying that it can discount somehow from that lump sum because more would have accrued by the time they were 65. I want a specific on what this pre-retirement mortality discount is doing.
Well, what it's doing is it's accounting for the possibility of death.
They die, sure.
But it's accounting for the possibility that they're going to receive nothing. And
even though the spouse is going to receive, in fact, under the section of the plan 5.1, whatever it was that you just said.
And the spouse,
all of it.
Yes. And at the highest level of generality, we're too lost in details, because even though all the details are in our favor, the point of Berger was saying the stepping into the shoes is at the plan in Berger equated the account with the benefit. That aspect of the plan was unlawful. So the corrected plan is equating the account with the benefit, but with the projected account. So that's what's going on here, as in Berger, essentially. It's the plan, once it's corrected, it's one and the same thing. There's no loss whatsoever. It's the benefit.
So I want to go back to this 8.2 versus 5-year rolling average and all of the rest of it, because it seems that the point that Ms. Benson is really stressing is that maybe even if 8.2 were an acceptable interest credit rate, so is the 5-year rolling plan, and we ought to defer to the formula that the plan adopted in 2011, and thus find no violation and no remedy due.
We have difficulty understanding what the defense's position is, because it's so clear what occurred here. There was a plan that had a projection rate that was invalid, that was determined by the district court to be invalid.
And that's the original 1998 plan.
That's right. It was a full-blown trial after summary judgment proceedings that were themselves full-blown. The district court wrote a 50 or 60-page opinion. Later, after trial, a 70-page opinion. They use the word damages a lot, and they throw that word around as if, you know, we can just forget, you know, the man behind the curtain, that there were all these proceedings, because that was a damages proceeding.
But, you know, you're touching on one of the crucial things here, which is how all that earlier stuff about the 1998 plan relates to what the case has now evolved into, which is a case about the 2011 plan amendment. It seems to me what you're saying is that, yes, the plan was amended, but didn't mean the whole 98 plan was thrown out. There were lots of it that stayed the same. Certain things were amended, and that's what reset the clock.
Exactly. And what stayed the same? The thing that nobody's really directly talked about. The interest crediting rate, that 75% of or 4% interest crediting rate.
So that formula stays the same even after 2011.
That's the heart of the case. And what the defense is doing is completely pretending like this amendment changed the world. It changed nothing.
All I want to is a very simple point. And if you get this, you could slice through all of this. We had a trial. What was the subject matter of the trial? What is the value of the right to receive in the future, year in, year out, come what may, 4% when the stock market is tanking and everybody is losing their shirt that year and losing all the gains that they had? These people were getting 4%, the incredible wealth preservation feature. This is what Judge Crabb was so impressed with at trial and when she's questioning these experts. And in good years, you participate in the upside. 75%, you have to take a haircut. You don't get the full amount, but you've seen the rates, 17% in 1 year, 9% in another year. You can't lose. It's like going to a casino every night. You win, you go back, you win again. You can't lose. And what happens is, over time, the participant's right is more valuable, actually, than the future value of the trust returns itself. That's what they determined when they were doing all these stochastic modelings.
Because of the 4%.
Because of the floor, exactly. Power of the floor. And what is just the pink elephant in the room here is that is what people accrued their benefits under. That's their right. They had that accrued right to that into the future. And all, of course, that Berger held 10 years ago was the right to future interest credits. Berger, according to what they themselves said in the district court and to the IRS, they're talking out of both sides of their mouth. There's repeatedly, we have in our brief, they're saying Berger didn't decide how you do it. The rate in Berger had nothing to do with this rate. They themselves say that because the rate in Berger was a stable rate. The rate in Berger was a one-year treasury rate. The rate in Berger was not disputed between the parties as to how to value it into the future. It wasn't disputed, and Judge Posner says that in the decision. He just said, well, the district court looked at this non-discrimination regulation that only applies when you have an interest crediting rate that is a plain vanilla. This is the opposite of plain vanilla. This is a exotic, complicated, and very, very valuable equity-based interest crediting rate.
So let's pick apart what here is a question of law and what's a question of fact. Because certainly the district court, as you say, holds this lengthy trials, whatever, it's a four-day bench trial or something like that. Here's all these experts, all these different methodologies, picks the 8.2 as not the highest possible rate, but as something that she thinks is the soundest given the testimony.
It was very, very conservative. They were, if anyone has anything to complain about, it would be the plaintiffs, because she had this overlay of, well, the sponsor would be reluctant to go with this higher rate. We don't agree that that's the way to do it, but we're not assigning error.
But anyway, so there is certainly, as a question of law, you know, how one reads the plan. That's contract interpretation and the like. But then once you are asking, you know, as of 1998, how would you have implemented a valid interest crediting methodology, not knowing what the future was going to hold, of course, and she takes that perspective. So there's a question, is that the right perspective to take?
They didn't dispute that. They went along with it to the extent that they say that they made some general statement. They never said you don't look at it that way. And you have to look at it that way because of, in Thompson, the court made clear the holding of Thompson. They focus on footnote 17 and build castles in the air based on footnote 17, but they ignore the holding of Thompson, which is the no discretion rule. We can't defer after the fact, after somebody's earned all their benefits, and let the employer decide, like, oh, well, this is the value of your benefit. Thank you very much. And that is a key element. And Judge Crabb, by the way, she channeled Thompson. She found that before Thompson said that, because earlier in the case, on summary judgment, they said, hey, you know, if you strike down the 30-year treasury, send it back to us, and we'll figure out what the rate is. And she wrote an opinion that effectively predicts what Thompson would say, citing all the regulations we cited, that says That violates the ERISA no discretion rule. So I can't defer. In fact, that was Judge Stadmuller's mistake, which was why he had to get remanded. And then when he, as you pointed out, Judge Wood, when he then looked at it, he said this 5 year isn't going to capture the value. When you have, if you look at her district court opinion, she reproduced a chart that showed the wild swings of this rate, and then against it, the 30-year Treasury, which you could use the one-year Treasury in Berger. These are just horses of a different color. But in terms of the what she found was, at a minimum, the projection rate has to be 8.2. That's point number one of what was on trial.
But
that
is unchanging after they amend. Yeah, that's what
I want you to talk about.
Why is it unchanging once
the interest, because the interest rate, they don't even argue that. They argue unbelievably incredible things. And we really would like you to consider finding waiver, because I'd like to identify, even in her argument now, counsel says this thing about this congressional statute. They refer for the first time in their reply brief. That's not true. The Treasury regulations exempt equity rate of return precisely because of the skewed results you'll get. Judge Hamilton, I think you wanted to ask a question, but I can continue. What I wanted to say was the other thing that's unchanging is the the other thing that comes up at the trial that's already tried, that she holds a trial over, is their 1 to 5 year average. Three reasons she rejects it. Number one, 8 out of 9 years, it yields less than 8.2%. You don't have to go any further in this case. She made a predictive fact finding that the defense in their reply brief concedes. If you find, as is so obvious, that Judge Crabb found the amended plan violated ERISA, they admit that that's a her finding as to 8.2 as the minimum rate is a predictive fact that you have to defer to under clear error. It's right there in their reply brief.
Just to nail it down, it's because the amended plan doesn't change the 4% 75% formula.
Correct.
Had that changed, the 8.2 would have had to be reconsidered.
That I agree, but it couldn't have changed because that would have been a cutback. You can't change that retroactively either, and they didn't even try to do that. What they tried to do was impose, and this was the point I was trying to get to, the second thing that happened at the trial was they had the full and fair opportunity to litigate the 1 to 5 year rate as being ERISA compliant. Three reasons it was not. One, we just said, it wasn't 8.2 except for one of the 9 years. So when she found that
their response to that is, what's so magic about 8.2? You know,
my response to that is, Judge Crabb held a trial and she found as a matter of fact that is only reviewable on clear error that in the future, that future interest credits on average over the long term are going to be no less than 8.2%. End of story. That's it. She said that is the ERISA finding that she made. The plan had to have done that analysis. Doesn't matter that you could have used the Black-Scholes method that they offered, stochastic, a long-term average. She considered all these things. This plan sponsor could have done all this stuff in 1998. In fact, the dirty little secret is the plan sponsor did do all this stuff, except for the purpose of finding the projection rate. They did it for the purpose of plan funding. They did it for the purpose of asset allocation. They had all of these things in hand. They ignored them because they only wanted to pay the account balance. But she found that 8.2 is the ERISA required minimum. So at trial, she considered their 1 to 5 year average. And when she wrote her opinion, she said, well, it's not 8.2%, 8 out of the 9 years. But I find two independent reasons I also can't do that. Two reasons I urge the court to find waiver. They knew, she wrote extensively, it's in our briefs, in her opinion, they knew what she found. Their opening brief not only pretends that she didn't find that the plan violated ERISA, the amended plan.
The plan, well, maybe we should say the plan as amended, because if the whole thing wasn't thrown out and a new thing put in.
Exactly, and actually that leads me to, it's the amendment itself as applied that she says at the trial, if you were to do this, even if you could do it, reason number one, even if it didn't violate the 8.2, now in 2011, it's just not possible for two totally independent reasons. They didn't address either of them in their opening brief, and they don't even address one of them in their reply. Timing and gaming. Timing is the right that was being discussed in the argument. You're correct that she finds that 8.2% is the accrued benefit. She, in effect, discovers that that is the value that must be given. And when you pay less, that's cut back. But there's another cutback that you were talking about with the NCAA brackets, Judge Hamilton, which is you have a right, and it is so false. It's right there in our brief. It's right there in our submission to the court. The anti-cutback statute and the 411D4 regulations that we cite, they specifically say timing, optional form of benefits, Q&A 1, Q&A 12, they had the right. And in fact, Judge Crabb took a break from the trial and she went and she, because she asked us all about that, and she realized about the timing. And she asked Mr. Deutsch about that, about this whole thing, and she took a break and she went and she came back, and she realized that that was part of people's benefit. Don't get tricked.
Choosing when to take their lump sum.
Exactly.
Sure.
And they use the word decrease. Well, that didn't decrease anybody's benefit. That's not ERISA. ERISA and the Hines case in the Supreme Court, it wasn't about the dollar amount. It's not just the dollar amount. Benefits, rights, features. The feature is I can time my distribution when I want for the most value for me. And what Judge Crabb is saying is it would, she uses the word unfair, for that just read illegal. If you were to impose retroactively.
So if somebody had left Alliant and gone to a wonderful different job, they might have wanted to postpone their distribution. Because
and if you told them, if you
to.
Told them that we have a future interest crediting projection that uses the one-year average, which is they say is an awful thing, but it's embedded in their 1 to 5 year average. This is right. Where the argument started. You picked up on that, so it's disqualified. They disqualify their own proposal. So if you tell somebody that, what are they going to do? Under the Amara v. Cigna case, Justice Breyer talks about, you know, the water cooler. Everyone's going to figure it out. And then they're going to look at the stock market in December. And they're going to say, you know, is it a hot year for the stock market? So they could just time it and just say, okay, I want my benefit. You put it in before December. How bad is the market going to turn in 1 month? So exactly for that reason, she says, number one, hey, they had a timing right. You, having the benefit of hindsight and seeing how there were these three awful consecutive years that they themselves in communications to participants said are completely unprecedented, where the stock market was down 3 years in a row, we're going to use that. And she said to them, you know, come on, that's completely unfair. You're doing this in hindsight, and it's also not the value because it's not 8.2%. But that gets – so that's a completely disqualifying thing. It's absolutely – inaccurate, and you should find waiver. They don't address that in the opening brief, and I have more things I could say, but why should I have to stand up here and give you an argument? But gaming, let me talk about that briefly just.
And then I hope you'll talk about the statute of limitations.
I do want to talk about that because that.
Maybe you should go to that first.
Okay. Let me just have 1 second on gaming. The gaming is part of the no discretion rule. The no discretion rule, what Judge Crabb is saying is, I, as a matter of ERISA, cannot allow a plan sponsor to have a rate retroactive that I find, as a matter of fact, they never would have adopted without the benefit of hindsight. And they never address that, ever. Okay, statute of limitations, very important, Judge Hamilton. Discrete act. they ignore the Ledbetter decision, Morgan, the Ledbetter Title VII decision by the Supreme Court, which says you can always charge within the charging period a discrete act that violates limitations. And they, in their reply brief, make our point unwittingly when they're trying to convince you that Judge Crabb never found their plan violated ERISA. They say, of course, page 11 of their reply brief, of course a plan sponsor's corrective amendment can always be questioned. Thank you. There goes their statute of limitations. In 2011.
Actually, that really doesn't answer the problem. We've got Thompson, which rejects the plan's more exaggerated theory, namely that giving you the summary plan description about how we're going to calculate your lump sum in the future starts the clock. That's out under Thompson. But Thompson also pretty clearly rejects some of your more aggressive positions on the statute of limitations and says we start the clock when the lump sum is paid. Now, what I don't understand is how the 2011 amendment, which, as far as you're concerned, is completely inadequate to cure the injuries your clients suffered years earlier, creates any new injury. It's a failure to correct, but how is it a new injury?
It's, respectfully, that is not the way to look at it, a failure to correct, because it's an affirmative, discrete action, and all the cases Judge Crabb cites, and the Ledbetter decision, which she also cites, it's a new action. It's not a passive failure to correct. And they took an action where they go back in all the cases. There's a long string of cases that she cites that we provided her, and she agrees. And the Martin decision that's binding on this court, same thing. A second error committed is a new error.
That's a completely different kind of problem, though. Your folks had already gotten their money, right?
Your Honor, they retroactively, they said that yes, but they retroactively said, they said as of January 1, 1998, they said this amendment is retroactively effective, so they effectively undid everything.
No. Okay, the amendment did not ask for any refunds from the plaintiffs, did it?
No.
Okay. Presumably, if you applied it fully retroactively, there would be some refunds due to from some plaintiffs, right?
No.
No?
No. Let me just start with the new
injury.
Let's
go in a different direction.
It's a different injury. If you want to just jump to injury, it's not the same injury.
How are your clients worse off in 2012 than they were in 2010?
They weren't worse off. That's the frank answer, but it doesn't matter for two reasons. The focus is not on injury. You can have the same injury reimposed. It's like a scab. They went and they picked at it. They did another act.
It's not like Mr. Martin being put back in prison for another 10 years.
It was a new – they went back and they reconsidered. Forget Martin if that doesn't do it for you. Sir,
it doesn't.
Sir, please, what I'm trying to get across is it's a new action. Under the Ledbetter decision, the Supreme Court – it's a discrete action that they take. Nobody forced them to take it. They went back and they said, here's how we're defining the ERISA benefit. And Judge Crabb said, nope, you did it wrong again. It is a new injury. People were not worse off. And she directly addresses this in her opinion, her November 2011 opinion. Things changed. They went back and they reconsidered. And this isn't a gotcha, sir. This is they adopted a thought about it, and they adopted a new definition, retroactively effective. It wasn't just, we're just kind of updating this and printing it again. It's not a gotcha. They went back and they made a new decision, and they amended. The focus of all the case law is on a discrete action. It can be the same injury, but we have it better than that. It's a different injury. They had never applied a pre-retirement mortality discount before. They had never deprived people of their timing rights before. These are new injuries. They have new consequences. Please don't just focus on the dollar amount, just like you shouldn't focus on the dollar amount for the timing right. We have new claims, and they did not simply say it mooted the litigation because people were made whole. They agreed, the district court found, that the claims were moot. And it makes sense. I understand your concern about it, but think about it. If you look at the plan amendment itself, it says retroactively effective January 1, 1998, you use this 1 to 5 year. It's as if the 30-year never existed. And they went back, very important, they recalculated every single person's benefit. And if they didn't get more, they didn't get more. They were re-injured then. They were re-injured because, okay, in our briefs we explain, there were a lot of people, if they hadn't applied the pre-retirement mortality discount, they would have gotten more money. Sir, we never had a pre-retirement mortality discount claim until 2011 because they always paid the account balance. What they do with the pre-retirement mortality discount is they, after they project more than the 30-year treasury, they then take it back, 10 to 15% of it, with the pre-retirement mortality discount. So it's a different injury. Every single person, this was not disputed, every single person would have gotten a higher payment in 2011 or a payment. Mr. Larson, he would have received a payment just had they not applied the pre-retirement mortality discount. It's a new action. It creates a new limitations period. And the injuries are different, but they don't have to be. Here's the same way it's relevant, the Martin decision, because if what this court held is it's nonsensical that when they take a new act, it could never be challenged. What if they just forgot to pay somebody and they came back? Read what they say. They say, what's their answer? Not a legality challenge.
Okay, I think unless Judge Hamilton has any further questions, I think we have your point. So thank you very much, and we will hear from Ms. Benson on rebuttal.
I'd like to start with the interest crediting rate issue. The panel asked whether the formula stayed the same. It did, but what changed was a supplemental complaint where plaintiffs challenged it under the amended plan. They said that it was the amended plan that violated ERISA.
And is there anything wrong with an allegation that this plan now, as amended, 2011, violates ERISA? I mean, obviously you don't think it does, but they think it does. So it's an issue to adjudicate.
So the answer is that it does not, as a matter of law, it does not violate ERISA under the holdings of Berger.
Right, but I just want to say that's kind of the question before us, and we certainly understand your view that the five-year is an acceptable.
And they, by filing that amended complaint, abandoned the claims under the original.
Well, they wouldn't have had any reason. No, they didn't abandon the idea that a 4%, 75% formula requires, I'll just use the word, adequate interest crediting. Now, there was zero interest crediting under the whipsaw. Now it was the five-year rolling, so the nature of the violation has changed. But I don't see that there's abandonment.
No, it was under the original plan, and you are correct that the injury remained the same, yes.
As to the interest crediting, but perhaps not as the pre-retirement mortality issue. You had not had any need to do that when you were just paying account balances.
In terms of looking when the statute of limitations accrues, you look to the first injury, not the last. The injury remained the same here. So
how much change in a plan? Suppose Alliant had just thrown away its 1998 plan and hired a bunch of great lawyers to come up and write a brand new plan, and now somebody wants to challenge that plan. Surely that's a new injury. It's a new plan.
If they were challenging,
it violates statutory rights under ERISA.
If they were challenging the lump sum distribution received under the old plan, it's not a new.
Well, they're saying that you redid it, and the new formula still doesn't comply with ERISA.
That's correct.
So, had you come up with a new plan that did, gave 9% or something, the case would have gone away. I see that. But if it's a new contract, in effect, why isn't it a new cause of action?
The injury is the same here.
Well, is it, though? It's the new contract that's causing injury. even though the general topic is a defined benefit plan.
The injury was the payment of the lump sum distribution. That injury did not change. It is the first injury, not the last, which causes the statute of limitations to accrue for this court to hold the claims that were absolutely barred under the prior statute of limitations are now not barred, is going to disincentivize a plan from correcting ERISA violations. I want to talk about the discretion very briefly. Plaintiff's counsel discussed discretion of the plan sponsors. That is not what Thompson holds. Thompson holds there's no discretion given to the plan administrators, but that the plan could correct a violation by obtaining an amendment from the plan sponsors. Once you have that amendment, of course the plan sponsors have discretion in terms of deciding that amendment. Now, the discretion here was exercised in order to obtain tax-qualified status for the plan. That's why this plan was amended. The plan had been trying for a very long time to get this tax-qualified status. There was a moratorium imposed by the IRS. It finally got the tax-qualified status. The district court knew of this all the way along. Before she issued her 8.2% order, she knew that the IRS was going to be or likely to agree with the up to 5-year average. So this wasn't some kind of nefarious amendment of a plan. What the plan was doing was trying to obtain tax-qualified status.
Okay. I think your time is up at this point. So thank you. Thanks to both counsel. And we will take the case under advisement.